Welcome back to Emerge. On this episode, I'm speaking with Jared James. Jared is actually a new friend of mine who I met because of the show. One of the great joys of hosting this podcast is when listeners find me, reach out to me, and engage me in conversation. You know, this is part of my learning process. I've actually had a number of people on the show who I met through the show, who have emerged as a result of the show. And so Jared and I have had a number of quite interesting conversations. We share a lot of interests in common. And on this episode of Emerge, we have a discussion about stream entry, which for those who aren't familiar, we'll kind of dive into it, various definitions on the show, but it has to do with awakening and liberation as a result of a contemplative practice. Stream entry is specifically a term from the kind of Buddhist canon, and it is a term of art that both Jared and I have played with the meanings around. And so we explore that. We explore the topic of the relationship between the philosophical investigation of things like free will and impermanence and its relationship to meditative insight. We talk about the relationship between insight and being of benefit in the world. And I share a story about an awakening that I had through playing World of Warcraft, which is actually very significant in my own development. Beyond that, we talk about kind of meta patterns between domains, as well as the need to follow our own curiosity as a kind of path through the various interests and passions of our life. And if you enjoy this conversation with Jared, I highly recommend you check out his podcast. It's called Impactful. And unlike these long, languorous conversations that I release that are hour and 15 minutes, he has extremely tightly edited, compact, and dare I say, impactful episodes based around particular topics, many of which are related to topics explored on this podcast. And they do go in somewhat of an order. I highly recommend, and I'll link to this specific episode in the show notes. Jared created an episode on tribes and meta-tribalism, which if you enjoyed a previous conversation with Peter Lindbergh, you'll find a lot of resonant themes explored in that episode. So yeah, definitely check out Jared's podcast if you enjoy this, or even if you just want a new experience. It's really well produced and well worth your time. And if you'd like to support Emerge, there are two ways you can do that. You can become a supporting listener by clicking on the show notes, the link in the show notes, or by going to anchor.fm/emerge. Or you can leave a review on iTunes. That is very helpful in allowing more people to discover this podcast and the conversations. And as always, if there are people that you'd like to hear on the show or feedback or anything else, feel free to reach out to me to connect with me. I love to hear from people who are listening to this show. And perhaps like Jared, it will lead to us having our own conversation that we can share with the listening audience. I think playing with this division between listener and participant is something that is very fruitful and alive and fertile for me. And I hope that it produces a good experience for you too as a listener. So without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Jared James. Welcome to another episode of Emerge. On this episode, I am very excited to welcome a kind of friend of the show and participant in the larger conversation around the show, Jared James. Jared, welcome to Emerge.
Thanks. Happy to be here. And I've been a fan of the show, as you said, and been following closely. So great to be on the other side of the mic.
Yeah, totally. And this is, you know, I'm so happy to have you. I mean, you've been kind of participating in the show off air for some time now, as we've been having conversations. And, you know, one of my dreams when I first started this show was that we could create a kind of context in which we could amplify some of the conversations that we're already having, and that people could tune in and get caught up in whatever it was, the conversations that were happening, and then, you know, could then come on the show and sort of feed back into this cycle. So it's very edifying and pleasing to kind of have this opportunity to share you with the audience, and then hopefully encourage other people who are listening to reach out and, you know, share their own stories and see how it all weaves together. Because I think that they're, you know, in as the namesake of the show suggests, there is a kind of way that we're constructing each other into a new kind of emergence. And I think that I'm excited to have a conversation with you where we can kind of demonstrate that. And so, happy to have you here. And the context of our conversation is, you know, Jared, actually, well, why don't we start this way? Jared, why don't you just sort of give an introduction to yourself for those who aren't familiar with your work, so we kind of have a starting place to go from?
I've kind of bounced around in many different areas throughout the years, but recently kind of found myself in the contemplative or spiritual world, and I think that's what led me to you originally, and kind of focuses a lot of our conversations. Right now, I've been spending my time kind of rebooting a podcast of my own that I did in a bit of a trial run back in 2016. So I'm getting back up and running and kind of incorporating a lot more of this my contemplative journey along the way, since recent experiences or insights have kind of quite changed my perspective quite a lot. I think that's kind of describes where I'm at this moment, at least.
Right on. Yeah. And so there are, as we've, you know, geeked out about before, there are many topics, I think, that we've discovered together that we could spend and have spent hours talking about. But what we felt like would be interesting to share in this context was a kind of dialogue and conversation around meditation and awakening, and in particular, this concept of stream entry. And so, we're going to begin that conversation by just sort of unpacking what it means when we say the word stream entry. And then we're going to kind of talk about how it is that we have encountered or unfolded that conception of stream entry in our own lives, how we've even, you know, well, I won't go too far into it before we kind of define what we're talking about. So Jared, what is stream entry to you, and what's your relationship with that term?
The first thing that comes to mind is a big caveat, and that is obviously that words can be tricky. And while I'm pretty new to the spiritual space, there tends to be quite a bit of discussion over what constitutes stream entry. Early on, I wasn't really that interested in it, it kind of crystallized, my conception of it crystallized when I ran into some of the work of Jula Dassa, and his way of describing it simply from a Buddha Dharma naturalist perspective, of just saying that if you have an inside experience that leads to a deep belief that the self doesn't exist, removal of any doubt of the path to enlightenment, the kind of rejections of rites and rituals and ceremonies as being kind of the hallmarks of what somebody is looking like after they've had some experience. But that being said, like I just mentioned, it sounds like there's a lot of people who might say that things like cessation or something might be needed for that experience, and I definitely wouldn't characterize my experience as being a cessation one. I was lucky enough to have some sort of experiential, embodied, no self experience, and mostly cued by an introspective observation of kind of dependent arising. At the time, I didn't have any of this language, so the way I kind of characterized it as was, I'd spent a lot of time thinking about free will for many years and reading about it philosophically and everything like that, and had gotten through like early phases of understanding the academic argument and being able to recite it, to eventually getting a little bit deeper to the point where I felt like I had an understanding and even could view what the world would look like if this free will wasn't existent, and that was a kind of a more visceral experience. But then when I had this no self experience, it was kind of like, I'd understood the concept for a long time, but never could feel it. So it was a complete embodied awareness of this absence of free will. It was like, seeing and feeling the strings that were pulling the puppet of Jared. So,
right.
I hope that's an interesting way of describing it.
Yeah. And I guess I'll add to that, from my path, I first, I think, learned about this term stream entry in the context of this book, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, where, if you meditate long enough, if you're not really only doing like a mindfulness-based stress reduction or corporate mindfulness training, eventually you're going to encounter some kind of concept of awakening. And in the Buddhist context, that's usually talked about in terms of the four-path model of awakening, the first of which is stream entry. Traditionally, that's how it's spoken of. If you then get further into this rabbit hole, that you discover that there are then many different perspectives on what stream entry is, who's got it, what the ramifications are, how do you tell? Like, there's a multiplicity or plurality of perspectives within the tradition about what this is. And so, we're not trying, I think, here in this conversation to say that we know what the answer to what it is. We're more talking from our personal experience and kind of playing with, I think, what it has been like for us and what that might say more generally, or just trying to, say some interesting things, I think. And the other way that I've heard it described that I think is a useful way to understand it if you're not familiar with it is that it's kind of like entry-level awakening. Right. So that's, I think, a nice way to conceptualize it. It doesn't mean that you're like a totally enlightened bodhisattva where flowers are coming out your butt, but it does mean that you have sort of, as I think Rob Berbea has said, that some of the insights that a lot of the meditative techniques are attempting to get you to see has somehow seeped into the marrow of your bones such that they can't really be forgotten. Mm-hmm. And that does change your life. It's changed, it does change your life. And so I guess establishing that as a kind of basis, maybe the first thing I'd be curious about, Jared, is like, I think it's interesting that you didn't have this kind of scaffolding, this conceptual scaffolding in your process. And I'm curious, like, what your experience was like, how you understood it, and what the kind of ramifications have been in your life.
Yeah, I mean, to echo your sentiment too. Yeah, I The four path model has been super helpful for me. And when I did run into that, it was kind of the first time that I had read or heard somebody articulate something that, you know, resonated, you know, almost, you know, in a very profound way. And so, you know, that's part of what attracted me to start looking into Dharma a little bit more, as opposed to some more secular variants. You know, probably the most spiritual exposure I had early on was from people like Sam Harris or something like that. So it's just a very rational, deconstructive approach to what these experiences were like. But yeah, you know, from my perspective, it was very disorienting in the sense that I kind of had a general idea of what I was going for. You know, obviously trying to describe that without having any, you know, the depth of knowledge that really does exist in the Dharma, was very frustrating. You know, I think the hallmark for me, being that, you know, when you verbalize the shift in perspective, it's actually very subtle. It wasn't like, you know, when it's said out loud, it doesn't sound like something drastically different. But the way the experiential feeling of it is completely different. You know, without a doubt, there's never been an experience that I've had in my life that was more perspective shifting, or more impactful, you know, in how I, moved on from there, whether it was in my career, my relationships, my relationship to myself and everything, because it's very much a recontextualization. I don't know if that answers things, but I maybe give some little bit more context there.
Yeah, well, I'd be curious to hear you unpack that just a little bit more about what that perspective shift afforded you or changed in the context of your relationships, your job, your life.
Yeah, well, I would say the really funny thing is, you know, as we mentioned, I guess the interesting place to start is if now I'm looking at a lot of the contemplative teachings, there's a big emphasis on, you know, right livelihood, right action, right speech, things like that. Mm-hmm. And as I look at my my intellectual and kind of life philosophy and how it evolved in my early adult life, I'm able to kind of draw these very clear connections to the same insights, but I just got them from extremely Western secular perspectives. So, you know, I was very interested in the science of happiness. So, you know, I spent a lot of time looking into psychological studies and correlative correlations and things like that seemed to stand out for me. And it became very clear. I didn't understand exactly why, but there seemed to be a clear correlation that a life of service and commitment to others and a healthy social life was something that should be established. So, you know, in a very kind of robotic way, I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll be very nice to people. And, you know, I started a little nonprofit on the side because I wanted to start giving back as well. Because my career previously had been, in the marketing, solely in the marketing space. On top of that, you know, then we start moving into some of that free will stuff, which points to some of this interconnectedness, no self, impermanence type stuff. I was also very interested in, I had become enamored with the concept of death and was doing kind of contemplative, meditations of some sort, like completely self-manufactured, pretty much every morning, thinking about my own death, the death of people close to my family, because I felt like that urgency to, you know, live fully. And so yeah, I kept finding all of these corollaries, whether it was through philosophy, science, ethics, and everything like that. And now I can almost reconstruct every single every single one of those in the Buddha, Dharma, or you know whatever other contemplative spaces that I've spent a fair amount of time in.
Yeah, and those symmetries are fascinating for a number of reasons. You know, one of the things that I really am drawn to personally and that I attempt to do a lot in this show is revealing those kinds of symmetries, right, between disciplines that point to something that maybe is therefore a little bit more dependable. Like maybe we're actually talking about something quote unquote real when both positive psychology independently discovers certain attributes or techniques or technologies that are consistent with a 2,500-year-old tradition like Buddhism. You know, that's interesting. And then there's the other thing that I think I'm particularly drawn to in this conversation, partly because of my own, upbringing within the Dharma world. So a little bit more background for me. So this book, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, is associated with a larger kind of Dharma movement in the West called Pragmatic Dharma, which had a lot to do with like a kind of recipe cookbook approach to awakening, right? So you kind of sit down and you do this technique and deconstruct your phenomenological firsthand subjectivity kind of at a sufficient degree of consistency and depth, or I don't know how to frame it exactly, but in the right way. And then presto, you've cooked yourself up a stream enterer or something like that, we might say. And so in that context of pragmatic Dharma, there was no sense, I think, of how our intellectual inquiry, say into the nature of free will or whatever, could have any bearing on whether or not stream entry happened for us, quote unquote. And so I wonder if, I want to just kind of spend some time there. And what does that bring up for you? Like, how do you relate to that kind of tension or that question or that possibility?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that pops into my mind, right, is kind of that kind of classic cliche of fake it till you make it. In many ways, I was kind of living a life of somebody who might have had some insight into interconnectedness and selflessness. But I'm sure on a subtle level it was there. But I was mostly doing it just because it was part of the equation. Ironically, though, after this experience of no self or whatever we want to call it, I don't really care to put a label on it, but it seems to point in some direction of stream entry. I was finally, after that experience, I was able to then actually feel deeply connected and embodied with that sense of service and connection to others. And, all of a sudden was like understanding why I was doing the things that I had done. This is why I'm giving back. This is why I'm volunteering. This is why I started a nonprofit. This is why I don't lie. This is why whatever. it's a lubricant. I look at it as, if you build a life that makes it slippery, you can definitely fall down that hole if the conditions are right. That being said, I still had a very modest practice. I do think that the contemplative side of things is a needed ingredient. Whether it's a formal practice or it's finding it in sport or hobbies, one thing I do think I got a lot of kind of built a lot of concentration up from, and maybe some awareness as well, that more peripheral awareness, I played a video game semi-professionally for like 6 years, where like I played 35 hours a week, and I was commonly going into flow states when I was at the peak of my play and stuff, and so there were a lot of, as I look back, there were a lot of ingredients that I didn't know I was already started preparing that I think really aided me in the long run.
Nice. Yeah. And that's, I guess, part of my interest, and this is just because, again, of my own, what I didn't see when I was started my path is like all of these ingredients are part of it. And then, in fact, like we can use everything in service of this larger journey, which maybe isn't even about or isn't about stream entry. It's about like learning and inquiry and just discovering what this life is. And I think one way to kind of explicate that might be just to focus on this topic of free will that you mentioned around, you know, what is it about the philosophical investigation of whether or not we have free will that might like lead to liberation? Like, why is it that, or yeah, maybe explore those symmetries a little bit so that we can spend some time playing there. I think that might be interesting.
Yeah. Well, so one thing I would say, you know, from my experience of being in these spiritual tribes and kind of or visiting them from time to time and getting to know people a lot, I usually see kind of two types of people. You know, if I have to generalize it, I'm sure there's many more. And one of those folks are really interested in the suffering, the reduction of suffering and fulfillment purposes of the spiritual path. And then the others, I would say, are a little bit more squared in the pursuit for truth field. And you know, that is so fueled by curiosity into the nature of our experience. You know, and I think that if I'm looking at things like dependent origination, there seem to be a lot of correlations with free will, right? It is, you know, there is not a cause, there's no cause without an effect, and vice versa. And if you take that to its logical conclusion, you know, you understand that, that it seems likely that all of your decisions, quote unquote, have come from previous events, and most of which, were out of your control, or preceded you. So yeah, it both pulls away some of the ownership, of your actions, and connects you deeply in kind of a temporal element as well, is feeling like a chain of causality that is far bigger than the individual. And yeah, I'm definitely expert of when it comes to dependent origination, and I know that there's many complexities that should be considered. But I feel like there's definitely some symmetry from my experience.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, one of the teachers that I have studied with most, Rob Berbea, you know, he talks about how, for instance, this idea of there not being a self, which is sort of core to the Buddha Dharma, is an actual practice, like that you can use it as a kind of just way of seeing your moment to moment experience. So like, and he recommends using phrases like, you'll sit and you'll say, you know, something, whatever is arising, you'll say, oh, this is not me. This is not mine. Right. And kind of, impose that way of seeing your experience on your experience, that it doesn't belong to you, that there's no self here that's controlling it, that's just happening, so on and so forth. And in a way, that's the same thing that's happening when you unpack this idea of there not being free will. It's like you can't help but then start seeing yourself and your actions in the context of a world in which there is no free will. You know, I hear Sam Harris is really big on there not being free will, and, you know, understandably so, given his meditative background and stuff. But when he talks about how there is no free will, like when he makes a persuasive argument, as he does, like I can feel my self sense evaporating as he's making the argument. Like he's giving pointing out instructions, and I don't know if most people are hearing it that way or what, but there's a way in which even inquiring into these topics starts to reveal this way of seeing reality that is liberating.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, and maybe just an interesting kind of side note here is my journey into this path of further and further understanding what lack of free will would actually mean. Starting out as, you know, like kind of a memorized thing, and moving more on to a deep understanding where you're able to connect it to, a larger perspective, and see how it would affect many, many things. And it broadens a bit and that becomes a little bit more impactful, all the way to, what led to the dissolving of self in my experience, which was a more embodied perspective. The interesting thing here is that I actually, Sam Harris was the first one who I really started listening to about this free will stuff. I read his book. I listened to many of his lectures. You know, I probably at least 8 to 12 hours of Sam Harris droning on about the logical consistency of this idea. The understanding was starting to develop, but it actually wasn't until I ran into some fiction. I was reading, it was Kurt Vonnegut. It was either Slaughterhouse-Five or I think it was Slaughterhouse-Five, which has these aliens in this sci-fi slash historical fiction novel that's just fabulous, that are fourth dimensional beings. And so, you know, time is a dimension for them to move back and forth. And his poetic, creative way of describing it is what took that intellectual understanding and actually let it break through to a more robust understanding that was connected in very deep ways. So the interesting thing is, like, you know, finding a ways of really embodying these philosophies, I think always has to be a multidisciplinary approach. And then eventually leading to that insight experience, I think that was, you know, very much dependent on a lot of Vipassana work that I was doing, so that I could actually see myself constructing itself in live, in live action. So, I don't know, just a fun little side note to kind of show how many different influences need to circumstances that had to come forward, and kind of coalesce to lead to that experience.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, what's coming up for me is, you know, the way I'm projecting, and I don't know if this is true for others, but the way I sort of compartmentalized my intellectual life and my spiritual life, being like, I'm doing this practice that is driving towards awakening or whatever, freedom. And then I'm listening to arguments about free will over here. And those were merely taking place in this kind of like abstract realm of logic and like linguistic kind of inquiry. But there's actually, I think that whole time, if somebody had just said to me like, hey, actually, this is all part of one process and you can leverage what you're discovering over here in this other context and even vice versa, right? That there's a way in which these domains really ideally are interpenetrating from the very beginning or as soon as possible anyways, I think that is really of interest to me and is one of the kind of perennial, I think, inquiries of this show.
Yeah. 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 We're 100% on the same page I think we probably had a very, some similar experiences and I wouldn't even have labeled having any kind of spiritual interest as I started having some of these quote unquote spiritual experiences. I think, the way I've been defining it, and I think I introduced in the kind of introduction for this podcast to kick back up, was I kind of look at it as two complementary approaches to self-development, one being thinking. Creating and utilizing and remixing these models in a very free-form way that is align with your curiosity, your interests, and your kind of personal psychology. And then fusing them and working with them to then move into this being quality, where it becomes an embodied, less conceptual, less abstract, expression and starts becoming more present and embodied experience of actually verbing as opposed to nouning in the first.
Right. Yeah. And then again, like the work you do on the level of being informs your thinking, right?
They feed each other.
Yeah. They feed each other and they grow together. And for me, like that is where much of the juice is now for me, is the way in which our intellectual life, our concepts about the world play together with our perception. And it's just like, it's so rich. It's so infinitely rich once we reveal how these two quote unquote separate domains actually interpenetrate each other and inform each other, and don't try to keep them separate as if like meditation is this opportunity to like be non-conceptual or something. So right there with you. Go on.
It always starts from that conceptual foundation and is informed by it and probably limited by it as well. So the mm-hmm. further you expand that foundation and further you strengthen it, the more territory you're able to be with.
Great.
And I do have, maybe this might be an interesting time too. One of the other things that I think is really core here, and it probably was a necessity to start having some of these being experiences for me at least, was also trying to see some of the nature, this nature of impermanence, but through more of a philosophical lens. That was from my experience, I don't think I could have had, some of those, that profound experience if I hadn't have already started to glean, this idea of impermanence, even though, or emptiness, even if it was through a super philosophical lens, And so, I don't know if that might be a fun way to go.
I'm curious what that philosophical investigation of impermanence looked like for you. The free will thing is quite obvious to me, but I'd be curious to hear more about the impermanence.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, so definitely, the impermanence and then emptiness is the big one as well. So, impermanence, I guess I'll start with the impermanence one. Impermanence, the kind of obsession with death for quite a while, was obviously a big player there. Another kind of thing that I look at as a very much a positive thing. I was actually, born with a genetic condition called cystic fibrosis, and have had a number of kind of health run-ins that have acclimated me to my own impermanence in a very visceral way, and so seeing that my own health is something that's fragile and experiencing it deeply, I think also kind of was a subtle and yet deep enforcement of this idea of impermanence as well. So that I think was also probably a key aspect of my experience. Mm-hmm. And also the way I reacted to it as well. I was lucky enough that I think I was so young that when I started having to deal with some of these things and having to do therapy and go into the hospital and deal with a lot of these kind of more adult things that usually we don't have to quite deal with. As opposed to being paralyzed by it, I was lucky enough to fall into the circumstances that I kind of came out the other end with some equanimity about it, which made, if you can bring equanimity to that experience, it makes it that much easier to bring it to a lot of other stuff too. So even from a young age, I've always been kind of described as that kind of person who's always okay with the way things are, even in tough circumstances. So that I think has been super helpful. is probably one of the main unfair advantages that I've had, even though most of the time people mm-hmm. can conceptualize it as a unfortunate experience. Mm-hmm. And then moving on to the emptiness stuff, this was more of a that same curiosity that was driving a lot of the inquiry into science and philosophy and ethics and everything like that. Because I was, avidly very aggressively looking for truth, I spent a lot of time in a lot of different tribes, for lack of a better word, that all, were claiming to have these truths, whether it was in diet or, or ethics or philanthropy or, psychology, or relationships or whatever it is. Going into that experience and having the curiosity being the key motivation there, often led to me removing myself from these tribes eventually when I kind of ran into some of the limitations. And after doing that so many times in so many different areas, it became a very kind of like embodied idea that no single, I'd like to call it now, map, is really going to describe the territory. And so being flexible is with all of these different concepts and ideas and theories and models, was definitely I was acting from a place of emptiness, and allowing myself to be flexible, with many things. I'm sure that was a major ingredient into being able to disregard, the self as well.
Nice. Yeah. I think that's so important. I mean, there's two things that stuck out to me. One is this kind of through line of curiosity and just to kind of double click on that, I have noticed in the spiritual tribes, as you say, that I've walked in, that one of the common elements of people who really take this stuff really far is that sense of curiosity, right? It's the people who attempt to be kind of like meditation robots and just sort of like end their experience through careful noting that, they might get somewhere, but I do feel like the path really opens up for folks for whom it is an expression of a kind of larger movement of curiosity, of which this path is just like an expression of. And so just like naming that, I think, is really important. And also wondering, as I often do, like, am I still curious about the domain that I'm in, or is it time to move on? And am I kind of like clinging to it out of a sense of, identity, or wanting to, milk it for more than it has to offer? And then the other piece that I think is really interesting, that what you were saying brought to my mind, is that when I look back on my own kind of path, to use that word, which I don't particularly like, but I'll use it anyway. One of the first moments of kind of awakening, if we want to use that term in a way that probably some people won't like, is I was really into this game World of Warcraft, right? And you're probably familiar with the game. For people who aren't, it's like a massive online role-playing game where you kind of you create a character and then you go on quests and you level up and you do all these things in the context of the game. And I had this character, and it was my second character. I'd already like maxed one character out. And I remember I was like, one of the activities was called grinding, where you would just sort of like kill creatures to get experience, to go up in level. And I was grinding, and all of a sudden this thought came into my head, like, what is this actually for? Like, why am I grinding right now? What's the purpose of this? And it was this kind of like metacognitive move within the context of World of Warcraft that, I just had this thought. This thought just arose in that game as I was playing. And then all of the interest and the excitement of playing just was sucked out over the next couple of days and weeks. And I just stopped playing. And actually, like, that's kind of interesting, you know, in and of itself. But then there is this kind of meta pattern that, looking back, I can identify, and I think you're speaking to it too. There's both the meta pattern of exhausting a domain, right, and kind of going beyond it, but then there's also this capacity to see those patterns as you move between domains over time. And again, there's that through line of curiosity. So as long as you keep being honest and like moving forward and being willing to be in the kind of state of dissolution, like after you realize that World of Warcraft isn't gonna be your path to eternal happiness or whatever, and you're like, oh, what am I gonna do now? And then, you know, at that point in my life, I actually started getting into like exercise and things like that. Like, that was a moment of awakening where I was like, oh, actually, I'm overweight and I'm interested in girls, but they're not interested in me. I should probably do something about that. You know, World of Warcraft isn't my ticket, I guess, anymore. And so, it's just interesting how these things that I think we typically think of as like not spiritual, or so to speak, you know, I'm doing air quotes behind the microphone, you know, with the right frame of with the right context, actually can be opportunities for insight.
Yeah. I mean, well, and this probably is, you know, that sums up my dislike of the word spirituality, because I think it is inherently, you know, or implicitly saying that this is a separate from everything else, right? So you know, that's why, if everything is sacred, that is such a better frame to approach any and every experience, and makes it, you know, filled with potential to have any of these connected moments. It's funny you said, one of the other things that I think is important there too is this relating or connecting a lot of the learnings and applying them to other areas. You know, if there's, you know, I don't have any prestigious degree at any colleges or anything like that, and pretty much all of my learning was self-directed, and so completely directed by my curiosity. And the while I have a lot of big deficiencies when it comes to like my memory, you know, time is really hard for me to identify whatsoever. I have no sense of geography, you know, like these major gaps. Mm-hmm. But one thing that has always been there is that I've been pretty good at remembering the conceptual framework of these different philosophies, ideas from different fields. And I think it's because I got in the habit of making sure that anytime something was resonating with me that I was connecting with from a genuine place of curiosity, I was trying to relate it to something else that I had gone through, other experiences, and put it, you know, kind of puzzle these things together. And, you know, I think that points to, you know, another one of those big words that is really important, and that's that interconnected nature. You know, as soon as you start seeing that all of your pursuits are connected in some fundamental ways, you know, that can be extremely liberating in so many ways, and also lets you fully, you know, incorporate them into your world model that much better.
Yeah,
or that much quicker.
Yeah, and it liberates so much energy, I think, and curiosity, and you know, I was reading this paper recently, and it was by an educational philosopher who's a very radical person, and one of the things he said is something like, you know, if passion isn't present, is it even learning? Right. Yeah. And it's like, I think that's something that we both of us share. And I think it points to a kind of new possibility in today's world around what we used to call autodidacticism. But I think increasingly is just like what you need to do in order to discover your niche in today's world.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you can no longer afford not to be passionately engaged with your own emergence, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it really describes the importance. You know, the thing about curiosity and passion is that they, it can get a bit complicated from a semantics perspective, but and I'm willing to say that there could still be subtle clinging in exploration of curiosity, but it's definitely a curious exploration or a passionate exploration is usually far less connected to an outcome than I'm going to start lifting weights so that I can, you know, look strong it's a very selfing, a self-oriented behavior that is reinforcing this idea of self and in the process alienating us from everybody else in the prospect and in the process. So finding these, I almost look at them as vehicles for your practice is really important. I think curiosity is one. I think a lot of people, get it from more of a heart-centered, love expression, connecting deeply with something in a loving way, or even more of a looking for some sort of groundedness or sense of security or identifying with that groundedness that's persistent, the persistent quality in our experience. All of these things are far less contaminated with individual wants and needs. I think just as a thinking person myself, curiosity is usually the vehicle that I'm hopping into. It's the most accessible because my brain likes to think.
Totally. I want to shift gears a little bit, but before we do it, there's what you just said reminded me of Ido Portal, the kind of movement expert or what trainer or whatever, who, if you're listening, you don't know who he is, look up some videos of him. He's really inspiring in the way he moves, but he talks about how in the realm of movement, and I think this is, again, one of those things you can then apply to other domains, but it's when you actually achieve the thing that you are going for is the moment that you're fucked, right? Because at that point, what are you doing? Like, how are you moving forward, right? That's the point at which people start to get real sad and, things start to fall apart. And so finding some kind of form of motivation that isn't based on the achievement of a discrete goal, is just so important. And I just think that's a fun example from another domain of somebody who, I think has discovered that too.
It gets reinforced over and over again.
Yeah, totally. And the more you see it, the more you see it. And so I think what I'd like to do now is kind of talk about, both of us have, I think, a really deep interest in being a benefit to the world, broadly defined, being a part of that our actions in some way, shape, or form might be part of making the world a better place, to use a kind of cliche. You frame it in terms of impactful. I guess I would like to talk to you just about, what is the relationship in your mind, having studied all these different disciplines and kind of also with the exploration that you're going on with Impactful, what's the relationship between this thing we call stream entry and being of benefit to the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, there's many paths we could take here. I think that in the simplest way, the core of pretty much every spiritual practice that I've run into all point to recontextualizing the way we see ourselves. If that means that you're something bigger, or if it means you're something that's not there, or you're God or love or whatever it is, it always is expanding that definition or abolishing it completely. And if one of the easiest and most natural human ways to express non-self-attachment is just through serving others. And any time you go into any experience with the clear and with the predominant intention of serving others and helping others. I think that it weakens that connection to yourself and that connection to outcomes for yourself. That would be the through line, I'd say, at the most fundamental space. But I think the other thing here is the thing that's complicated here is that there's no guarantee that those intentions are always going to lead to the most impactful outcome. The way everybody's individual experiences, perspective, and preferences are will determine the best way for them to act out of service. Sometimes that means creating and inspire creating deep connections with your family or close friends in a way that inspires them to do something bigger. On the other end of the spectrum, you could dedicate yourself to philanthropy and aid to try and lift people out of their unfortunate circumstances. And the key thing here is just that I think the best path is usually the one that is that is interesting, engaging, and easy to be embodied in. Because if you don't choose the one that is aligned with yourself, it's easy to burn out and start damaging yourself and in turn your ability to serve in the long run. So it's a delicate dance. I wish it was more simple, but everybody's got something unique that they can give. And every time they do, they're, detaching a bit more from themselves and feeling a bit more connected to something bigger.
Yeah, that's well said. And I think that what comes to my mind is that, it's so easy. And I speak from personal experience here for our ideas of service to become a kind of vanity project. Right. And there's all kinds of ways that this can seep in. And I think that often we don't realize it until we see how resentful we've become, or we see that, oh, in fact, what I thought was of service was not. Right. And that there is, I think, a shift in perspective that comes as a result of contemplative practice and perhaps of something like stream entry that doesn't exempt you from those vanity projects, but at least helps you to see it when you're doing it a little bit more clearly. And it seems like that is that tendency to be mistaken about our own intentions or to not see our own intentions clearly is the kind of like generator of a lot of problems, even within the context of, oh, I'm being of service, right? And so, that's what came to mind as you were sharing that. And I think that's,
I think that's the big thing for me is I don't want to speak for the whole spiritual space, but it seems that stream entry is often looked at as like, this is the place where then you can kind of start floating. I've gotten there. Now I'm just going to slowly awaken over time. I feel like that's like seems to be the core insight that people have eventually after being in that stream entry is you develop enough mindfulness and get enough clarity on your own motivations. And you start to see all of that subtle underlying attachment. Which is terrifying at first, but then energizing for showing you how much work is left to done.
Totally. Yeah. It reminds me, my teacher at the monastery would make fun of this kind of perspective on meditation where he would jokingly and I think scathingly say that the people who thought that you get enlightened and then go home, that it's just like, and it's funny. It's exactly the same thing that Ido Portal is talking about, right? If you think that stream entry is going to solve all of your problems, you're going to be very disappointed. You're going to be extremely disappointed. Right. And maybe some of that, it might be necessary as a kind of, form of motivation, but I don't know how much of that is necessary.
Yeah. I mean, the cliche thing that I always like to say is just, achieving and getting the things that you want in life is the best and worst thing that happens to us. It shows you the impermanent nature of it and the illusion of arriving and disillusionment and can often lead you to dark places. Mm-hmm. But it also shows you the emptiness of that pursuit and it's an opportunity to revel in the process of being and thinking.
Right. I think that one of the things to reflect on or that I wonder about is how much that perspective that you just said is a kind of like quote unquote byproduct of something like awakening, and how much of it can just be a kind of belief or conviction that we opt into regardless of if we've ever meditated in our lives, and if that's the case, then I highly recommend you don't wait, if you're listening to this, and just choose to see the world that way, if that's possible for you. Because I think, I certainly operated under the assumption that and it's interesting, I really don't know, like when I was really gunning for stream entry, would I have been gunning for stream entry in the way that, really made a difference? If I thought getting stream entry isn't going to really solve my problems, I don't know that I would have. And so is that delusion necessary or something like that? Or is that perspective of this is going to solve it, whether, don't call it delusion, is that necessary to do the work that needs to be done?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is the sloppy thing. I like the way that Jewel of Dasa describes karma, and which is a little bit more of a deflated approach. And it's just simply that you never know the outcomes of of your actions or the actions of the world, and all you control is the intention. Whenever something happens, labeling it as good or bad, both of them are can be damaging, because each one of them is an opportunity to learn something, and each one of them could lead to something that's great. But it's just hard to tell. So staying a bit indifferent and just kind of being with it is maybe the key there. Depending, I'm sure the way you contextualize it afterwards is probably more important than when it happened.
Yeah. 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 That reminds me of, I got to a kind of similar place with Bonita Roy in one of my previous podcast conversations, where I was just like, well, so like, how does this help us really act in a way that is of benefit or that really makes a difference? And she was like, well, fundamentally, we just have no idea what the impact of our actions are. And she's like, that's one of those answers that people don't like, one of those real answers. I was just like, all right, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that honesty, and I think it's, as true as something can be, is the reality that regardless of our best intentions, we're gonna act and the chips are gonna fall.
We're this tiny dice rolling in the universe, and being in fact impacted by many, infinite amount of other dice. You never know when they're going to roll and hit into you, knock into you. That's the nature of interconnectedness, I guess. There's no one person is separate.
Totally. And I just add to that, and it's way more fun to imagine ourselves as being interesting dice that is, are really doing our best and are aligned on this beautiful vision and mission. And that is actually makes that process of being a dice blowing in the wind or whatever to be more, beautiful at the very least.
Yeah. 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 I mean, even, something that, like we said, you don't always have to have these big insights, that lead to some of these same conclusions. And I remember years ago that the life metaphor that I was obsessed with is looking at life as a roller coaster, And you know, as soon as you're strapped in and moving, you know, you're going in a, you know, on a path that you have zero control over, and you can either enjoy it or you can close your eyes, and you know, sometimes you're going to get sick or whatever. It's, you know, it's just be with the experience. And the cool thing is that I think there is no other. There is no other rider that is you, or who has the same experience. So there is a uniqueness to it as well. And the paradoxical thing is that to fully experience that uniqueness, you have to let it go at first, which is just such a strange and you know, awe-inspiring aspect of so many insights that lead to this strange non-dual acceptance.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I mean, that feels like a good place to draw this conversation to a close. Not really. Like that's beautiful. I think that's well said. And I think that that really does, you know, encapsulate, as you say, the strangeness and the beauty and almost like the kind of, I think, awkwardness of that, of that kind of way of seeing. And it's an awkwardness that I live with every day and that I wouldn't trade for anything. You know, and so any kind of final words before we end this conversation?
No, I don't think anything's coming up to me right now. But yeah, I think we covered some good ground, and hope that nobody looks to see as perceive what I've said as any kind of truth claim or anything like that. Holding totally. All of these maps at a distance, and I'm committed to none of them. So,
right. Yeah, and I'll just say this is something I've discussed with somebody or actually, I'll say this: if you're a kind of easily offended Buddhist, that seems to be, for some reason I've noticed, one of the easiest internet subcultures to offend. I'm just going to go ahead and direct your concerns to Vincent Horn at Buddhist Geeks. You know, he's developed a good process for, I think, fielding such concerns. You know, don't send them my way. Thank you very much. But and I hope that we didn't offend you. But if we did, you know, www.buddhistgeeks.com.
It's all emptiness. Yeah.